As Romain Huret explained earlier, over the last 50 years, an essential paradigm shift has occurred in the historiography of America. Simply said, historians have moved away from a paradigm in which the United States was seen as a liberal country, inhospitable to conservatism, to another in which conservatism has become the norm of American political life. For consensus historians writing in the 50s, conservatism was totally alien to American political culture and was therefore dismissed as a, I quote, a paranoid style, a political pathology, or a status anxiety. In the liberal imagination, Lionel Trilling observed that liberalism is not only the dominant but even the sole intellectual tradition in the United States. In the liberal tradition in America, Louis Hartz went even further. He argued that the lack of both a feudal aristocracy and a class-conscious working class meant that America was the world's purest example of a liberal society. As for Daniel Bell, he wrote in The End of Ideology that the fiery clash of left and right had been replaced by a cool debate about management techniques. Trilling, Hartz, and Bell had two things in common. First, they all considered the aspirations of the new conservatives, that is, people like Russell Kirk, Peter Viereck, Francis Wilson, as nothing more than a strange, futile quest. Second, they all defined conservatism as an aristocratic ideology, that is, the ideology of a single, specific, and unique historical movement, the reaction of the feudal aristocratic agrarian classes to the French Revolution at the end of the 18th century. This vision of conservatism as an aristocratic ideology was seriously damaged by the so-called conservative revolution of the 70s and 80s. Between 1964 and 1980, the right progressively gained ground. The foot soldiers in the South and the West gradually became a more unified army. Conservative intellectuals began to shape policy, while demography continued to drag America in the southwestern direction. All three forces came together in 1980 in the shape of Ronald Reagan, a man whose philosophy was exactly the opposite of Lyndon B. Johnson's liberalism. Government was the problem, not the solution. The Reagan phenomenon and its aftermath has led some historians to reread American history. Maybe the U.S. had always been a conservative nation after all. Maybe American conservatism had deep roots in American institutions and founding principles. Maybe conservatism was in many respects a norm of American thought instead of an aberration. This sudden realization produced a number of valuable studies of the development of conservative thought over time. In The Populist Persuasion, for example, Michael Kazin showed how right-wing ideas had in fact dominated populist political discourse throughout the 20th century. As for Charles Dunn and J. David Woodard, they produced in 2003 an ambitious study of American conservatism ominously entitled American Conservatism from Burke to Bush. In that book, they try to reconstruct an ideology that was largely hidden from view as it developed. The work of these scholars has had a great impact. Today, the majority of historians see conservatism as a normal action rather than a pathological reaction. Some even go as far as to view conservatism as an autonomous ideology, that is, an ideology whose appearance is not dependent upon any specific historical configuration or social forces. Well, I personally disagree with this vision of conservatism. Indeed, I think that most conservatives adopt conservative ideas in order to defend one particular established order, that their conservatism is instrumental rather than inborn. In other words, conservatism for me is a situational ideology which develops to meet specific historical needs. The question, therefore, is not why are some people born to conservatism and why others aren't, but in what political, social, cultural context is a conservative ideology generated? Well, nobody can answer this question in a straightforward way. What historians can do, however, is try to explain the reasons for conservatism's current success. And there are three ways to do this. One way is to look at the higher echelons of conservative power, that is, political parties, corporate elites, foundations, and think tanks. This is what historians like Mary Brennan, Kimberly Phillips Fine, and Alice O'Connor have done over the past few years. Other historians, such as Kevin Cruz, Lisa McGurr, and Jeff Roche, prefer to focus on conservatism at the grassroots, that is, on the work accomplished by local conservative militants and organizations. One final way to explain the success of conservatism today is to look at the ideas of the movement. After all, intellectuals are the ones who have articulated the formal strategy and concerns of the conservative movement and thus laid the groundwork for electoral success. Few syntheses of conservative ideas exist apart from George Nash's famous conservative intellectual movement in America since 1945, first published in 1976. Most of the time, historians prefer to focus on the ideas of one particular conservative thinker: James Burnham, Ayn Rand, William F. Buckley, Leo Strauss, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, or Frank S. Mayer. The biographical approach, though less ambitious in scope, seems to me an excellent way of looking at the conservative movement in America. Indeed, it allows the historian to vivify a subject which might otherwise be dry, and also trace the origins of the conservative ideas in the conservatives' personal lives, encounters, and reactions to particular events. As I said earlier, there is no genetic predisposition to conservatism. Many Federalists began as successful revolutionaries, and America's premier conservative, John C. Calhoun, started his career as a Jeffersonian nationalist. So the impulse to conservatism comes from the social challenge before the theorist, not the intellectual tradition behind him. Men are driven to conservatism by the shock of events, the feeling that a society or institution that they have approved or taken for granted may suddenly cease to exist. Finally, the biographical approach to conservatism permits to destroy any illusion of homogeneity that the conservative movement or its enemies might cherish and or foster. The history of the US conservative movement is a series of tensions, conflicts, clashes between strong personalities, and the biographical genre undeniably is the most convenient to tell such a story. Well, the arguments which I've just expounded certainly had an influence in my own decision to write a biography of Irving Kristol. Well, I thought that some of you might not know who Irving Kristol is, so here's a short biographical sketch. Kristol was born in 1920 in New York City, the son of a Jewish clothing subcontractor. In 1936, he graduated from Boys High School in Brooklyn and entered City College of New York. A Trotskyist sympathizer for years, he deferred from joining the movement until the spring of 1940, when he graduated from college and the Workers' Party was founded. A few months later, while working as a machinist's apprentice at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, Kristol joined the Shermanites in their departure from the Workers' Party to enter the Socialist Party. In 1942, he accompanied his wife, Gertrude Himmelfarb, to Chicago, where she began graduate study. Waiting to be drafted, he served as the editor of Inquiry, the press organ of the Shermanites. Finally drafted in 1944, Kristol saw combat in France and Germany as an infantryman and was discharged in 1946 as a staff sergeant. While living in post-war England, where Himmelfarb was attending Cambridge University, Kristol began contributing to Commentary, the Jewish monthly. In 1947, he returned to New York to become the magazine's managing editor, as it was becoming a major forum for anti-communist thought among intellectuals. This phase of Crystal's career began with a turn to religion and climaxed with his famous statement in 1952 that, I quote, "There is one thing the American people know about Senator McCarthy. He, like him, is unequivocally anti-communist. About the spokesman for American liberalism, they feel they know no such thing." He then returned to England to found and co-edit the journal Encounter, sponsored by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and later revealed to have received funding from the CIA. After returning to the US for a brief stint as the editorial staff of The Reporter, Crystal became the executive vice president of Basic Books, a position he held for the next 8 years. During this period, with Daniel Bell, he founded The Public Interest and in 1969 became Henry Luce Professor of Urban Values at New York University. In the late 60s and early 70s, Crystal began to lay the foundations for what later came to be called neoconservatism. According to him, neoconservatism was nothing more than liberalism mugged by reality. In other words, Crystal viewed neoconservatism as an attempt to defend Cold War liberalism, albeit by different tactical means. Claiming that the United States and the Western world suffered from a crisis of authority that was essentially cultural, and that the American government was crippled by overload because it attempted to do too much domestically, Crystal called for reducing the government and restabilizing the international order. In the late 70s and 80s, Crystal became closely associated with the Republican congressman from upstate New York, Jack Kemp, and the Arthur Laffer Supply Side School of Economics. Since then, his function has been to arm right-wing politicians and corporate executives with an ideological self-assurance that traditional conservatism has not provided. Through his connections with the American Enterprise Institute and the Wall Street Journal, and in lectures to business groups, Crystal has made his ideological services available for impressive fees. He has also established himself at the center of the neoconservatives network, arranging positions for those who think as he does on editorial boards and universities. Today, Irving Crystal is 86 years old and lives in Washington with his wife. Well, I just learned she died. Okay. So he lives in Washington and...
She doesn't.
And though he has not written anything since 2005, he's still active in the conservative movement. Well, now that you know more about who Crystal is, I would like to explain in greater detail why I chose to focus on his life and writings. Well, my project originates in a paradox. Though Irving Crystal is widely considered as one of the most influential New York intellectuals, and is often acknowledged as the godfather of neoconservatism or the Lenin of the new conservatism, well, I'm quoting Charles Krauthammer here, no book has been written about him. Some historians and political scientists like Peter Steinfeld, Alan Wald, J. David Hoveler, or Gary Dorian have devoted chapters to him in their respective studies of neoconservatism, but those pages remain very elusive and only select such episodes in Crystal's life as can illustrate their own vision of neoconservatism. Therefore, Irving Crystal's life and thought have never been studied for themselves, outside the restrictive framework of the neoconservative intellectual movement or the New York intellectuals. Well, I think there's a gap here that needs to be filled. Well, of course, the mere absence of a biography does not in itself justify the writing of one. So let me explain now why I think Crystal's life deserves to be told. Well, first, Irving Crystal is an interesting subject because his life is a kind of compendium of American 20th century history, a window on the Cold War world. His career, and especially his transition from liberalism to conservatism, reflects the general political evolution of the United States between 1945 and 2000. Crystal is also one of the most famous and the most quoted political commentators in America. He has taken part in all the great intellectual debates since the Second World War. Nothing has escaped his attention, be it in the economic, political, or social sphere. Though religion, criticism of the welfare state, and the necessity to invent a new conservatism undoubtedly are the main themes, the most important themes of the 600 or so articles he has published between 1942 and 2005. Even more important than his analysis of current events is the fact that he has managed to turn into a full-fledged actor on the American political stage. Since the 1970s, he has become the spokesman for neoconservatism, as well as the main purveyor of funds, positions, and donations in the neoconservative milieu, connecting the often disconnected worlds of academia, business, and philanthropy. He has become a fixer, a builder, on top of being a theoretician, thus illustrating Bernard Lahire's concept of the plural man. The result is that today it is almost impossible to study the conservative revolution of the 1980s without coming across Crystal's name. If Crystal deserves the plural man label, it is of course because he likes to cloud issues and to transcend barriers, but also because he has never managed to resolve certain internal contradictions. He defends capitalism but has not been able to reconcile it with the moral values he cherishes so much. Though a critic of the welfare state, he refuses its disappearance. Though a great reader of elitist philosopher Leo Strauss, he also celebrates the common sense of the average American. Though hostile to Darwin's theory of evolution, he opposes the teaching of creationism in schools. Though a partisan of a realist foreign policy, he has defended nation building in Iraq. Faced with such paradoxes, it is tempting to dismiss Crystal's thoughts as simply inconsistent and to forego any study of it. This is not the course that I have chosen. Indeed, I think that most of Crystal's reversals are rooted in precise biographical events and that they demonstrate Crystal's capacity to question his own beliefs. In that sense, I think that Crystal's contradictions are perhaps the true sign of the intellectual nature of his thinking. So here are the five main reasons that have led me to my talking about Crystal's life. So first, the fact that no biography of Irving Crystal exists. Well, this is my marketing argument, if you like. Then the fact that a biography of Crystal permits to reread the whole history of 20th century America. It is a biography of 20th century America, in a way. Then the fact that writing a biography of Crystal permits to bury oneself in the great intellectual debates of these last 50 years, and more particularly to reconstruct the genealogy of neoconservative thought of whom Crystal is said to be the godfather. It also allows to recount the career of an essential actor of American politics, of a man who, by migrating from the intellectual to the political sphere, forces us to reassess the categories of intellectual and political. And finally, writing a biography of Irving Crystal leads us to follow the rambling development of ideas which are often contradictory, provocative, and dogmatic, but never insipid. Well, it is still difficult for me to predict what the content of my biography will look like, but after a year and a half's work, I think I've got a fairly definite idea of the way I'm going to tell the story of Crystal's life. Well, one thing is certain, for instance, the story I'm going to tell will have nothing to do with hagiography. First, because Crystal, although he's been called the patron saint of neoconservatism, has not yet been canonized, but above all, because hagiography postulates that everything is given from the start, that life follows a pattern set at birth. The end repeats the beginning, in a way. A biography, on the contrary, must give priority to narration. It must describe the evolution of someone's thought over time. It mustn't try to homogenize this evolution. In this respect, the autobiographical essay that Crystal published in 1995 really constitutes a counter-model for me. In that essay, Crystal keeps repeating that his existence only confirms predispositions present at birth. I think it is fair to say that what might be called a neoconservative imagination is something that I have always possessed. Or later, I was born theotropic. Or, with such a bourgeois character, one which I seem to have been born with, it is not surprising that I left the Trotskyists. Or, again, I knew in my bones that I was not born to be a novelist. Well, this idea of calling is a literary device that I won't resort to. I also refuse to yield to a heroic approach to history, which would consider Crystal a great man, demonstrating extraordinary psychological qualities. The way he, the son of Ukrainian immigrants, has managed to get out of depression-ridden Brooklyn is certainly worthy of praise, but it does not mean that Crystal has transcended the codes of his era. What he has done is merely appropriate them like hundreds of other Jews of his time. A biography should not depict an individual life at the expense of the big picture. Nor should it do the contrary, for that matter. Otherwise, it risks becoming what historians call a modal biography. In that type of biography, the individual has value only in the sense that he illustrates a context, a moment, or a social category. The main problem of the modal biography is that it relies on circular thinking. For example, writing a modal biography of Irving Crystal would suppose that I already deem him representative of the whole group of neoconservative intellectuals, that I consider him an emblem, and therefore that I have a pre-established view of what neoconservatism is. I thus run the risk not only of concealing anything that might differentiate Crystal from a predetermined model, but also of never really questioning the neoconservative label itself. Is it legitimate? Does it make sense? What we see here is that taking the individual as a prototype leads to an epistemological dead end. Far more relevant to me is the approach which considers the biographical material in its singularity as a privileged entrance point to a specific period of time. This is what Frédéric de Coninck and Francis Godard call the individual progression model. This type of biography, rather than looking for a point of origin from where everything flows, or seeing the individual's development as pre-structured by exterior conscience, reintroduces chance in a narration that does not, however, neglect environmental constraints and the necessary character of certain events. In so doing, it accomplishes the real fusion between the singular and the universal, between the individual and the social, a fusion which should be the ultimate goal of all biographies. Adopting the individual development model instead of the hagiographic, heroic, or modal ones will, of course, affect the structure of my narration. My biography will not be a rereading of Crystal's life in light of its outcome, nor will it follow a sandwich pattern, a little bit of context, a little bit of Crystal's life, and then a little bit of context. The individual development model imposes, I think, a linear chronological narration linking context and biography very closely. This linear narration will not exclude specific focuses on certain essential episodes of Crystal's life, like the publication in 1952 of his article Civil Liberties, A Study in Confusion, which revealed him as a fierce polemicist, or his encounter 20 years later with Jude Wanniski, who converted him to supply-side economics. These episodes represent moments of transition, and as such, ensure a better understanding of the ulterior orientation of Crystal's thoughts and actions. The factual narration that I've just talked about will bring us from 1920 to today, and will thus cover 9 decades. Such a scope justifies, I think, an ulterior attempt at synthesis. This will be the object of this second part of my dissertation. And when I say synthesis, I mean less a summary than a detailed examination of such controversial questions as, when did Crystal become a neoconservative? Was it in the 1960s, as he claims, or much before that? What was the exact influence of Sidney Hook's, Leo Strauss's, and Reinhold Niebuhr's ideas on his thinking? Is his defense of religion purely utilitarian? Is he really an intellectual, or should he be defined as a counter-intellectual? Does he deserve the Godfather label? How can we measure his influence on American political life? Does he have any disciples? Are there any second-generation neoconservatives? Exploring these questions will usefully complement the previous chronological narration. It will also allow to multiply the levels of analysis and therefore prevent any risk of ossification. After all, the wish of any biographer is to recreate the movement of life through a narration that is itself as lively as possible. Maybe I can say a few words about my sources. As far as primary sources are concerned, I must say that I have plenty to work with. First, because Irving Crystal has published, as I said, 600 articles and about 20 books. I also have the transcripts of interviews that I've made last summer with not Irving Crystal himself, he was at the hospital, but his son, William Crystal, and some of his former colleagues, Leon Cass, Ben Wattenberg, Norman Podretz, Mitch Dechter, and I'm planning to do more of these interviews next year. I also have the personal papers of Daniel Borstein, Dwight MacDonald, Hannah Arendt, Robert Bork, and Reinhold Niebuhr, and maybe later the papers of Daniel Patrick Monahan. Well, I tried to have access to them last summer, but I couldn't. And finally, the Congress for Cultural Freedom and American Committee for Cultural Freedom archives in New York and Chicago. As far as secondary sources are concerned, well, I have nothing to complain about either, since although very few articles have been written about Crystal himself, a lot of books on conservatism and neoconservatism have been published in recent years, and some of them have brought to light, neglected aspects of Crystal's life. For instance, John J. Miller, in his book about the John Olin Foundation, entitled The Gift of Freedom, has highlighted the essential role played by Crystal in the reorientation of the foundation toward the funding of pro-capitalist and conservative organizations in the 70s. So I think there's a lot of scholarship like this that can indirectly help me for my biography. That's all.
Thank you very much, Aurélie.